from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. People today, lots of them, still read and study the works of a 19th century thinker named Ralph Waldo Emerson. They read his essay, Self-Reliance. They applaud Emerson's disdain for conformism. They learn from his writings about the individual's search for fulfillment. Eric Kinahan has come up with a fresh interpretation of Emerson, one that highlights collectivity and collaboration. Specifically, Eric reads Emerson as wanting to move beyond those things and narratives and preformed identities that separate and constrain us. In an interesting essay that Eric Kinahan wrote for the volume The Other Emerson, the University at Albany professor investigates a range of topics, including liberalism, homeland security, the activity of reading, and what he calls a politics of solitude, all as part of an effort to glean Emersonian lessons for today. He finds particularly interesting Emerson's repeated use of the term the common. Eric Kinahan is Associate Professor of English at the University at Albany, State University of New York. He wanted to make clear, not an Emerson specialist. When Eric joined me from a studio on the University at Albany campus last August, he began with these comments on Emerson and how he's understood on the question of individualism.
Emerson has been historically very often misread as being just a proponent of or a supporter of what he termed self-reliance, this idea of nonconformity and sort of a radical kind of individualism, which is very often what his thinking and writing is celebrated for. And yet, for Emerson, individualism, that sense of individualism, is just a starting point. At least in my Emerson, and sort of my reading of Emerson, it's a way of reconnecting back to larger collectives and commonalities. You know, there's a tension that exists in his writing and in his philosophy, that tension between the role of the individual and the role of the collective. And so he's seeking a kind of health between both. To have a healthy collective, one must have a healthy individual. And yet that individual health can't overshadow the collective.
And Emerson understood that people grow up and, you know, assume occupations, right? They get into some kind of occupation, they have some kind of social status that comes along with it or that comes along independently of that. What did Emerson think of those social roles, those roles in the social realm?
Well, on the one hand, social roles are, of course, necessary because we are social beings and we have material lives. And in his early essay, The American Scholar, he writes about that sort of necessity. And at the same time, there's a drawback if we just define ourselves through these social roles. As Emerson saw it, part of that drawback is that we tend to lose sight of our whole being.
Do these roles, in Emerson's view and in your reading of Emerson, do they isolate us from others, or do they in some sense bring us together with others?
They very much isolate us from others, and they can isolate us insofar as they become these sort of formula through which we think. I mean, one of the ideas that I work through in my essay is that sense of identification that we might have with a social role really sort of cuts us off from others to such a degree if we just over-identify with it. So a lot of what we need to learn to do, according to Emerson, is to introduce some sense of difference to how we think of ourselves as social beings, how we think of ourselves as individuals.
Tell us more about this difference. What do you mean by it?
There's a sense in which Emerson, if we look at essays, sort of the classic essay, Experience, for instance, you know, the essay begins on this very, very famous and yet curious note of sort of waking up in the middle of the stairs. You know, there are stairs below us and there are stairs above us, and we're very disoriented. And a lot of what Emerson believed and what he began to develop and through his thinking and philosophy is a sense that experience is really about a process of allowing oneself to become disoriented, about allowing oneself to become lost so that one can reorient oneself again, you know, not be overly defined by the path of one's life or what had come before. To not continually strive for what we might think of as that ultimate objective at the top of the stairs, but to actually sort of become disoriented and lost in the process of climbing the stairs, of experiencing life. And that introduces a kind of difference to our sense of self. It's disruptive. It's disorienting. It causes a kind of fracturing of one's own sense of identity in a good way. And sometimes we tend to, I think as a culture, become too scared of or apprehensive of the possibility of not knowing where we're going or not understanding who we are in the present moment or not really understanding the past. But for Emerson, there's this quality of mystery that has to be recuperated, and it's recuperated by actually embracing experience.
Eric Kinahan is Associate Professor of English at the University at Albany, State University of New York. Emerson, in his writings, repeatedly used the term the common. What does he mean by the common?
Well, one of the things that I explore in the essay is how, when he begins invoking this term, the common, he's really talking about the everyday, the quotidian, sort of the banalities of everyday life. There's this fantastic passage early on in The American Scholar, one of his early speeches, where he writes about, and I'll just quote from Emerson himself, the meal and the firkin, the milk in the pan, the ballad in the street, the news of the boat, the glance of the eye, the form and the gait of the body. And all these common things, like the everyday things of life, of what's, you know, cooking on the stove and what we might hear, the music of the street or what's going on amongst sailors or shipmen, what we see in sort of exchanges with other people's glances, that is all a way of reconnecting us with what is human. So very much what is common for Emerson, and even what we mean is sort of the day-to-day sense, the colloquial sense of the term, of like commonalities, our common sense things, is a way to connect us to one another, to a new kind of community, you might say.
It's interesting because he's both talking about the particular, right? The banal, the everyday, the near, I'm reading now from other ways of describing the common, the near, the most particular, the base. And yet he's also talking about the universal, right? I guess because this is all something we share.
Absolutely. Emerson is often thought of as being preoccupied with the metaphysical, the spiritual, you know, his term of the transcendental. But in order to access that sense of what is universal and common to all of humanity, he believed very firmly that one must begin with the particular, as you had nicely put it, C.S. That sense of what is base, what is common, what is that which we experience every day, because that is the root of experience, but to not be stuck in it. You know, part of what we need to do is to process it and to sort of find a meaning in the common, not to overwrite it, but to find some way in which it can push us to a different way of understanding how we might reconnect with others or how we might reorient ourselves to our own sense of who we are as individuals and as a people.
Ralph Waldo Emerson, the, you know, very famous essayist, among other things, in his essay, History, what did he say about the one mind common to all individual men?
So this sense of the one common mind, he wrote in History, there is one mind common to all individual men. Every man is an inlet to the same and to all of the same. He that is once admitted to the right of reason is made a freeman of the whole estate. So for Emerson, a lot of his investment in this idea of transcendentalism in the sense of sort of universality is a different access to a kind of rationality, sort of a common rationality that would be all-inclusive for all people. I mean, one of the mystiques of democracy is that it is a democratic form, but very often how democratic institutions function is in such a way that not everyone has access to that kind of rational thinking or has access to those things that allow for the development of a kind of rationalized engagement. And so one of the things that Emerson is invested in as a thinker and philosopher is thinking about a different sort of standard for rationality. And for him, that standard is very much a natural reason. And this is where he's very Jeffersonian, that sense of a sort of natural rights and inalienable rights, the sense of a kind of humanist foundation for all manner of thought, that every individual has access to this natural reason that can actually allow one to sort of reconnect to all of humanity in a way that is not exclusivist or excluding of others.
When you talk, Eric, about individual rights, a lot of people would think of liberalism, right? Not as in terms of liberal and conservative, but sort of the liberal tradition, the liberalist ethos in the democratic tradition. Can you talk about liberalism, and can you talk about, because Emerson apparently adopted a fairly consistent stance toward liberalism, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He never used the term liberalism, at least that I know of. This is really a term that I, for one, am sort of bringing back into my assessment of Emerson. I've been thinking through this idea of, as you said, a liberalist ethos as a kind of formal feature of democratic institutions and democratic ideologies. And when I use the term liberalism, I'm thinking about the ways in which, especially in modernity, and the ways in which democracy is configured as a modern ideology, a modern belief and political structure, there is an aggrandizement of the individual to such an extent that the individual risks becoming what is called atomized, just sort of an atom floating among other atoms. And Emerson, as we had talked a little bit about at the beginning of our conversation, was very critical of that understanding of a kind of atomized ethos, sort of this radical individualism where one is utterly cut off from others. The danger of that understanding of individualism is that it gives a false sense of what we might call sovereignty, sort of the all-powerful, omnipotent nature of the individual. And when you start thinking in terms of individuals who have, you know, this misbelief that they are all-powerful, then we have a society in which individuals risk sort of butting up against one another, not communicating, not actually establishing any sort of common ground. And so Emerson was very much interested in a way of creating a very tenuous balancing act between the individual and this sense of commonality or community, finding a way in which they might speak to one another. But liberalism itself as a kind of politicized ethos disallows that kind of tenuous balance because it tends to over-exaggerate the significance of the individual in the mix.
Where are we today with liberalism? What would you consider to be its specific, particular characteristics?
I think right now individualism, liberalism and liberal individualism are very much articulated through this persistence of a kind of identity politics. as a scholar who is working not in Emersonian studies, my own work tends to fall into the category of queer theory or queer studies. And that field generally is interested in investigating the limits of identification, the ways in which our insistence on clinging to certain kinds of identities close us off from other modes of connection, whether we think about it in political terms and in terms of coalition, or whether we think about it in more ontological terms or philosophical terms about identity, where we might want to prefer to see ourselves as always in flux, as always changing. So I think liberalism now, at this particular moment, is in terms of sort of this more philosophical register, it's articulated in terms of a kind of individualism that risks cutting us off from others. It also has economic articulations now. We've all heard the term, it's a common term of neoliberalism, in order to describe imperialism and the more nefarious forces of globalization now. And that has a different kind of understanding, the ways in which that sense of individualism then sort of leaks over into economic and class struggles for power and nationalist assertions of power that end up disenfranchising others. So I want to be careful in how I define liberalism and how I tend to talk about liberalism, especially in the context of this particular essay on Emerson, is that it really is more of the philosophical register than the register of political economy. But, you know, there's a way in which they very much do go together. There's this way in which the philosophical is one way to begin to open up other questions about how we might term it real-world relations work today.
His name is Eric Keenahan, K-E-E-N-A-G-H-A-N. He teaches English at the University at Albany, State University of New York, and we are talking about an essay, a chapter he contributed to a volume called The Other Emerson, edited by Branka Arsic and Carrie Wolf and published by University of Minnesota Press. We have a link to that book as well as to Eric's homepage at the University at Albany on our webpage, againstthegrain.org. And my name is C.S. Song. Let's talk about reading. The activity of reading, creative reading, I guess, is what Emerson called it. What is commonality? Okay, so we've been talking about the common, about the familiar, the banal. What does commonality have to do with the activity of reading?
Well, commonality is perhaps, we might think of it as sort of the end product of reading, of sort of what one hopes to attain through this very common and commonplace activity that many of us engage in. Part of what's interesting about Emerson when he's writing in the 19th century is that he perhaps tends to heroize reading a little bit more than we might be apt to today. And what I mean by that is he doesn't really acknowledge the fact that not everyone is able to read, which is an especially important fact when we're thinking about the antebellum period and that slaves were living in a period of enforced illiteracy. But for Emerson, he saw reading very much as having a democratic potential, that it is ostensibly an activity that everyone can engage in. And if everyone can engage in this mode of reading, then if they're reading correctly, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, then they are better able to produce or contribute to that sense of a commonality that he was striving after.
Yeah, and what would be sort of a correct kind of reading?
Well, it is that phrase that you refer to of creative reading, which is a phrase he introduces in The American Scholar. And when Emerson talks about creative reading, he's really asking us to read in such a way that we allow ourselves to surrender to the text. In English studies, which is my discipline, this isn't an uncommon idea at all. The idea that we perform what in English studies we call close reading, that we pay particular attention to the words on the page and the words direct us to a particular kind of understanding of the text or direct us to a different way of thinking and different way of conceptualizing our relationship to particular issues that might be treated or raised by a text. But for most readers, most modern readers, that idea of close reading or what Emerson called creative reading is actually quite foreign. That one gives oneself over so thoroughly to a text that one actually might risk something in the process of reading.
Right, and here maybe we get to the title of your essay. The last few words are an ethics of risk. So in what ways is reading a risky endeavor?
Well, reading is a risky endeavor because we are introduced to ideas that are not our own or to language that is not our own. And yet when we're reading, and if we are engaged in this mode of creative reading, we're engaged in such a way that we feel something for it. You know, there's in a lot of contemporary theory, there is this strand of thinking called affect theory about the ways in which either material objects or sometimes language or others actually affect us, have this visceral effect upon us that are seductive or luring. And one thing that comes about in affect theory is a development of idea that if we are lured by something that is not ourselves, whether it's an idea or an object or a person, that lure is both seductive and so therefore has those connotations of pleasure, but it's also disruptive of who we think we are, of what we seem to know about ourselves or about our world. And so for Emerson, his idea of creative reading is very much a kind of seduction, where we're seduced by others' ideas, others' language, and that seduction is a kind of experience. And as with all forms of experience for Emerson, it's potentially disorienting, disruptive. It changes who we think we are. And that transformation is very important.
And what is this process of disorientation and maybe, I don't know, losing ourselves as we read? What does that process have to do with commonality? Because it sounds to me like you're speaking more about a very individual, solitary activity where, you know, for example, if I'm reading, I'm sort of coming to terms more with myself as opposed to I'm necessarily establishing connections, say, across borders, across boundaries with other people.
That's a fantastic question. The activity itself is, on the one hand, solitary. I mean, Emerson, throughout his essays, recurrently goes back to this image of someone sort of retreating to a study, you know, retreating to a study to read, retreating to a study to engage in this activity of othering oneself, to do exactly as you said, to come into a different kind of relationship to oneself with who one thinks one is. And yet at the same time, if we think about it a little bit abstractly, even in reading, we're not alone. You can be sitting alone in a study, but if you're giving yourself over to what's on the page, if you're giving yourself over to someone else's ideas, then part of what you're doing is engaging in a different kind of relation. You become dependent on the page. You become dependent on that language. You become dependent on the author, on her ideas. And that kind of dependence is a different way of thinking about how two subjects, two persons, might interact with one another. This is what is disruptive of what we've been talking about earlier in terms of that liberalist ethos, where there's that sense of the sovereign individual who's all powerful. But if in reading you learn how to give yourself over to others and their ideas, to their words, then you're actually giving up some of your claims to that sense of sovereignty. So we might think of reading as kind of an exercise, a preparation for a different kind of interaction.
Let me read you a passage from an essay called History, penned by Ralph Waldo Emerson. He wrote, "Every revolution was first a thought in one man's mind, and when the same thought occurs to another man, it is the key to that era. Every reform was once a private opinion, and when it shall be a private opinion again, it will solve the problem of the age." How do you interpret that passage?
Well, it's a complicated passage. Emerson is writing about the ways in which ideas begin, as he often said, sort of in the privacy of one's own study, the privacy of thought. But when we begin to make our ideas public, when we literally publish them, we're reintroducing them into sort of a different field. Will they be taken up by others? And there's this way in which, at that point, the idea has a kind of life of its own, and it belongs in this sort of liminal space between potentially different historical periods. You know, what I write today, you know, it may or may not be true, but maybe 100 years down the road, what I've written will be read. And that belongs to a different historical moment at that time. But it doesn't belong to the moment just sort of without definition. It's brought into the moment through how one reader might interact with my writing about a particular idea, or how I am interacting with Emerson's ideas about the individual, about commonality. I'm giving them sort of an afterlife, or they assume a kind of afterlife by interacting with me. And so there's this way in which his once private idea, then made public, is reintroduced into my own private life as a reader of Emerson. But I'm transformed by this interaction. And in the course of my transformation, I reintroduce it to a public, you know, and this is where I'll invoke the philosopher Jacques Derrida, who had often spoken of the ways in which, you know, as professors, you know, our job, you know, my job is to profess the ways in which I've been changed by reading, the ways in which my experience of others' ideas have changed me, or where I see potential for what I have experienced in this transformation to perhaps transform others. And so there's a sense in which if politics begins through this articulation of ideas that is first a private articulation, then published, and then privately read, and then publicly professed, and in this process always transforming, depending on the context where it is, who's interacting with these ideas. There's this way in which we get a different sense of sort of politics as attached to the idea, not just ideology, but to ideas, the ways in which individuals are interactive but are not the end goal of politics, and the ways in which we're sort of rebuilding commonalities by all of us, you know, whether or not we're a professor, we're professing in some way, talking about our experience as readers, talking about our experience of others' ideas, talking about our interpretations of the political. For me, this is a kind of humanist faith, but also a faith in the humanities, which is a threatened sector of higher education in this country, and especially in this country, but globally.
Eric Kinahan joins us on Against the Grain. He's associate professor of English at the University at Albany. He's written widely on ethics and modern poetry. His book is Queering Cold War Poetry, Ethics of Vulnerability in Cuba and the United States. And we are talking about something he contributed, an essay he contributed to the volume The Other Emerson. His essay is entitled Reading Emerson in Other Times on a Politics of Solitude and an Ethics of Risk. We'll take a short music break and return with more from Eric. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Kinahan teaches English at the University at Albany at State University of New York. And we have a link to this really interesting book of essays. It's entitled The Other Emerson. We've put a link to that on againstthegrain.org. We've been talking about reading, and of course, reading about the plight or the situation of someone or of a group of people can make us feel sympathy toward that person or toward that group. Did Emerson believe sympathy was the way to get people to act?
Emerson's was very much interested in an idea of sympathy, but his idea of sympathy is quite distinct from how we ordinarily think of the term. We might turn to a contemporary writer like Walt Whitman to think about the ways in which we tend to construct that ordinary sense of the sympathetic. One of Whitman's famous lines is that he contains multitudes. And that gives us a sense of the ways in which Whitman set up his self, his understanding of his own subjectivity, as absolutely sovereign. He became, we might call it, sort of the yardstick by which he measured others. And so when he seeks connection with others, there's this way in which Leaves of Grass, his large, lifelong poetry project, that seeking connection with others in the poems of Leaves of Grass is a way of affirming who he is, of allowing himself to grow, sometimes at the detriment of others. For Emerson, sympathy is more sort of a preliminary mode, a mode in which we might be originally drawn to someone. But if we actually give ourselves over to that someone or to their ideas, and before we've been talking about text, but we might think in terms of testimony as well. And there's this way in which Emerson is very much committed to an idea of all writing as a kind of testimony, as a kind of witness. All creative reading comes out of treating all language and all writing as a kind of poetry. And he always saw the poet as a kind of newsperson of the world. And that's not a verbatim quote from Emerson, but it's in keeping with what he thought. One is drawn out of a sense of sympathy, but there's this way in which, rather than use yourself as a yardstick by which you measure the plight of the other, by which you measure the value of the other, there's this way in which you have to just give yourself over. You know, there's an end to sympathy. Sympathy is perhaps what drew you, but if you're going to really experience this exchange with the other, whether it's a word, whether it's an idea, whether it's a person, whether it's a thing, you have to let the other do the talking. In such a scheme, that sense of sympathy ends. There's no allowance for pity. So very often, Emerson, when he does take up sympathy, that word explicitly, he talks about it as related to egoism or egotism. There's one point in his writings where he refers to egoism as a goiter, as sort of this diseased part of the individual which needs to be removed. And that sympathy is symptomatic of that goiter. So there's this way in which it enables us to connect. But we have to move beyond in order to truly connect, if that makes some sense.
It does. I want to ask you more about Emerson on poetry, and in fact, your feelings about poetry, because when you were talking earlier about reading and creative reading, you know, people might think of, okay, well, let's say alternative histories, like A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. So you read that, and then maybe you get a very different sense of what's happened and you begin engaging with the past, with historical, quote, fact in a new way. And yet there's something about poetry and the way it's expressed that you find very compelling, that Emerson found very compelling. So in what sense does the reading of poetry or the reading of material that is set with a certain kind of poetic tone What can that help us do that might be different than reading, for example, a straight nonfiction account?
A lot of it has to do, a lot of the value of poetry has to do with what I had referred to as affect or as gesture. You know, I love Zen. I teach Zen all the time in my classes. You know, his alternative histories, his popular histories, are absolutely necessary. But there's also this way in which poetry might offer us also another kind of alternative history. It becomes a record of the way in which an individual, the writer, was feeling in relationship to his or her own historical period. Even when they're not necessarily, when the writers themselves might not necessarily be writing about, in explicit terms, what's going on. You know, it doesn't have to be agitprop or propagandistic poetry. It doesn't have to be a kind of historical realism. But poetry is always written in a kind of historical context. It's rooted. It's rooted in our experience, and it is a writing of our experience. And I'm speaking in generic terms, and I know that there may be poets listening, especially out there in the Bay Area, who might take me to task for talking about poetry as experience or in these personal ways. But that writing of poetry for Emerson, he saw it as also not only personal, but at the same time, as we talked about before, disorienting. Because what one is writing about is not just articulating one's experience, but in making that articulation of what one is experiencing, one is allowing oneself to reconnect with one's environs, historical environs, social environs, linguistic environs, in a totally different way, perhaps in a way that one is unconscious of. For Emerson, the writing of poetry, and this is where my own understanding of poetry is very close to Emerson's, is dictated from without. It comes from what is outside of us. When I write my own verse, there's this way in which I'm sort of lost. Or when I'm writing a poetic essay, like even this essay, reading Emerson and other times, I see as a kind of poetic essay because I don't even really remember writing it. I mean, I definitely wrote it, but I don't remember the process of writing and revising this version. There's this way in which I really was giving myself over to Emerson and sort of working through him in a way that I don't in my more intellectually scholastic, specialized, critical work. So that sense of the poet as having a different connection to text, to history, in many ways owes to the fact that the poet works affectively. At least my understanding of poetry and the writing of poetry, it's an affective mode in which the poet, as Emerson describes the poet, is really a great and sensitive listener, someone who's listening to what's going on. You know, I don't believe as much as Emerson does in an aristocratic understanding of the poet. He really believed that the poet was a truly sensitive soul who was sort of had a sort of natural nobility. But I do believe that the process of writing poetically or the writing of poetry entails a kind of listening. And it's a potential that we're all capable of. And this goes back to the idea of reading. You know, for me, writing poetically or writing poetry is itself a process of reading. It's a way of reading our surroundings and reading ourselves. And this comes as much from me as it does from that other Emersonian poet I had invoked earlier, Robert Duncan, who is someone who I've written a great deal about, who saw himself as a derivative poet.
By which he meant?
By which he meant that he derived all of his ideas from his readings of other people. That he didn't see himself as a kind of romantic genius. You know, not all his ideas began with him. And that's the greatest misunderstanding of poetry generally, is that poets are just sort of the originators of great and original thought, you know, sort of geniuses in their own right. But if we think about the word genius itself, etymologically, the word genius does not refer to someone from whom something springs. It actually refers to a place. It's the spirit of a place, which is also invoked by Wallace Stevens in the idea of Order at Key West, one of his fabulous, fantastic poems. This idea of genius is really about reconnecting to context, to place, and allowing that spirit to speak through you.
And here we get, of course, back to the common, right? Commonality, threads, and kind of lineages of ideas and modes of expression that flow through us and that maybe we contribute to in our own specific way, but that can't be seen as just original and originating from nowhere.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the shames of sort of a misunderstanding of Emerson's idea of self-reliance is just this misunderstanding that the individual can be the originator of their own thought. You know, but this is where Emerson is a complicated figure, and sort of his thinking has a little bit of ambivalence to it that we need to take into account. You know, all originality is never original. You know, it depends on good reading. It depends on really listening. It depends on trying to articulate more and more clearly the truth of things as one interprets that truth of things. But the great thing, and this is what I always tell my students too, is that readers, poets, philosophers, all of us, you know, we always fail. We never quite say what we mean to say. We never quite articulate that truth as we see it. You know, there's something elusive about it. And so part of what we just need to do, and this is the core of Emerson's thought, is really to just continually try to articulate it. And when it is a potentially political idea such as the common, you know, there's this way in which we might think about Emerson as a romantic thinker, you know, sort of an idealism that has no place in modern society. At the same time, you know, there's this sense, this hypersensitivity in his work, at least in my reading of his work, to the sense that that ideal can never be attained, that we always have to keep working for and striving for and trying to articulate that ideal. And that rearticulation reconnects us to the past and also pushes us forward to the future. And it gives us, you know, quite stupidly, is that one way to put it, I guess, and quite bluntly, is just gives us a reason to keep on living.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Eric Kinahan is my guest. He is an associate professor of English at the University at Albany, State University of New York. As we begin to wrap up, let me bring up an unlikely topic given the kind of poetic, philosophical context of much of what we've been talking about, and that is homeland security. Can you describe the features of this current age of homeland security that you find particularly interesting or disturbing, and tell us how Emerson and his ideas about reading and risking and listening, how those ideas might apply to the current age?
Yeah, when I first wrote this essay, this version of the essay was written in 2007, which was a very different time. In fact, when I did the final revisions of the essay for the book, which was published in 2010, when I did the final revisions, I took out some of the more timely reference points that I had made, including a few aspersions on the name of George W. Bush and Rumsfeld and others, and instead just sort of noted that it had been written in 2007. What was very much on my mind in sort of the context of my writing of it and how Emerson was speaking to me at that time and affecting me was the ways in which he was helping me rethink sort of my relationship to the political and ideological environment in which I was living, which is a time of homeland security, which continues today. Although it's not as at the forefront of public discourse as it had been 5 years ago. And very much Homeland Security, as I saw it, and still continue to see it, is really a cultural project. And it's defined as such, and had been defined as such, by the Bush administration and its formation of the Department of Homeland Security with its National Strategy for Homeland Security, which is a document in which it sets up a distinction between national security and homeland security. National security being a political and economic formation that's very much tied to the military-industrial complex, and the homeland project being more of a cultural project, which is about producing discourses about what it means to be a secure nation, the ways in which that security is defined by creating concrete and really strong divisions between and binaries between self and other. Bush's, you're either with us or against us, cliche statement sort of epitomizes that for me. If we're living in an epoch of homeland security, we're living in a moment when identity and identity politics are articulated in a particular way, where very much of the culture is premised upon an understanding that we must manage our risk. And I think, you know, in light of the economic crisis that had transpired since the original writing of this essay, you know, that idea of risk management is perhaps articulated, you know, has a different layer of articulation to it now too as well. But one of the things that I was interested in reading Emerson was the way in which he forced me, compelled me, to reassess my relationship to risk. That risk was okay. You know, even, you know, risky reading may seem to be very benign and not have much of a role. It seems to be very sort of this microcosm that, you know, belongs to academia, to the so-called ivory tower, where intellectuals can afford to talk about risky reading. What relevance does that have on the real world? But if reading is a kind of training ground, you know, a different way of giving us a critical relationship to a liberal ethos, giving us a different relationship to a kind of egotism and the sense of sovereign individualism, which begins by asserting one's identity and speaking against an openness to difference, then reading itself is just a small experience that helps prepare us to understand that risk is valuable, that liberalist ethos, that disavowing of those who are the so-called other, those who are different from us, it's necessary. It's necessary to overcome those ideas, to allow ourselves to be changed by others. And if that can happen through the reading of poetry, if that can happen through the reading of Emerson, then yes, it is a small experience, but it's just a first step. A first step that can have effects in how we then go out and interact with others, how we're willing to be perhaps more open with others as both cultural representatives and as individuals.
And finally, I wonder if you could do me the favor of going to the last paragraph of your essay in this book, The Other Emerson, page 196, and I wondered if you could read for us the first six lines of that paragraph.
Sure. What we do in the privacy of our studies, that is, how we read, enables us to live in a critical and potentially political relationship to ourselves and our culture. The best readers among us are those who are affected by ideas, which are always strange to and originate outside ourselves. Ideas and thought are the secret substance of potential commonalities. They are improper and belong to no one and to no age.
Do you care to elaborate on that, or maybe that's an excellent place to end?
Well, I think that final paragraph is just making that gesture, a parting gesture, to reiterate a lot of what we've already been talking about for this past hour, which is that even though we might see and might experience reading as a private experience, something we do alone and is solitary, it is transformative. It changes who we are. It estranges us from who we are. And so with that experience, you know, when we then re-engage with others, when we leave our studies, we then have the potential to take this different and transformed self and interact differently with others as well. And so it sort of passes it on, that experience, whether or not we're professing, you know, the ideas that we've read, or just simply living the effects or affects of what it is that we have read.
If you go to againstthegrain.org, you can find a link to my guest Eric Kinahan's faculty page at the University at Albany, and to his book Queering Cold War Poetry, and to the book The Other Emerson, to which he contributed the chapter that we have been talking about today. Thanks so much, Eric, for joining us.
Thank you, C.S.
And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Song. You can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. Check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. And many thanks to Wesley Burton, who's at the controls today.